Welcome to the CCTA Wake Up Call Show. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for visiting our sponsors and supporters. And we're recording this just after the Memorial Day celebration and Memorial Day recognition. I'm not going to say a celebration, really, but my name is Bob Griswold.
Mary Griswold.
Alan Harrop.
Pat Park.
Glenn Fink.
Well, welcome. And Kim should join us a little later on.
If I could just start with this, but I never served, but we did, Kim and I did go to the National Cemetery on Monday. It was a good turnout. Rain came pretty hard in the middle of it. We had a covering, and we were able to weather through that and stayed for the whole thing. But that event is well done. You know, they recognized people with wreaths, and of course, at the end, you know, they close in a prayer, then they do a 21-gun salute with muskets, you know, muskets, and then, you know, I start crying when they play taps, and but it's a good event, those people that can go do that. And there are very few national cemeteries in North Carolina. I only saw two listed, but there may be more than
I think there's only two.
So some of us forget the price,
and one's full,
that has been paid for our freedom since 1776.
Yeah. Anyway, just
and we right have we
why don't
have
we start off with your comments.
But did
we're on the air?
We're on the air. Oh, excuse me.
I'm done.
That's we why have, you had to say your name, Alan.
We have okay, three military veterans here, and I realize that Memorial Day is in recognition of those who gave their lives, but it's still important to recognize those who served. So we're going to talk to our military veterans and let them tell a little bit about their story. Pat?
Okay, I'll go first. I'm an Air Force veteran, 22 years service. I went in the Air Force in 1974. We had separate but unequal. The Women's Air Force still existed. We had our own chain of command. And in basic training, we didn't shoot guns. We had makeup class. Our fatigue uniform was a wraparound skirt, a Navy one with a cute little blue blouse to go with it. Things changed pretty quickly after that. 1974 was a time of great change in the military because they had been pushing women to go into the military. They were letting us into to more fields and whatnot. But the Air Force, I did some research on how women came to go into the Air Force in 1974 when I did. And it was because they were starting, if you remember, the all-volunteer
yes.
force. Because they were convinced that at the end of the draft after Vietnam, that the men would be MIA for a long time, so they wanted a lot of women to establish the all-volunteer Air Force. So one of our first women generals, and I can't call her name right now, she wrote a book, Women in the Air Force, and she was talking about the conversations that were going on in D.C. about letting women into the military. And the Air Force decided that we'll just put them in there and see how they do. Okay, and we that have learned to be planners in the military know that that is not the way you start a mission.
No.
Yeah, let's just see how it goes. So I was one of the first 50 women to get to West Berlin. I was a Russian linguist during the Cold War. And if you recall, West Berlin was still an occupied city. So I was awarded the Occupation Medal, which makes me a veteran of a foreign war. And if I do say so myself, I think I look pretty good for a World War II veteran. So at any rate, the first 50 of us, we got to Berlin, and we were shocked at our reception because the men that had been doing that job, one, were convinced that women couldn't be linguists, which is a silly proposition. Women have been learning foreign languages for, it used to be a mark of culture, You know, if you were a Brit, you had to speak French. Any rate, the men didn't want us there. Our colonel had been in the military a long time through World War II. He was stunned. He actually built a wall with a locked door in it to lock us behind doors, all of our dorm rooms, so the men wouldn't rape us. He was convinced that we would all get raped. And so there was the young men that went through basic at the same time we did, that we traveled over there with, they were fine with us because, you know, we'd all been through school together. We were dating, we're having a good old time. But the guys that had been there, you know, for a while, they were horrified. So by the end of the 2 years, I think they were pretty much used to having us around. But when we first got there, it was quite a shock. But at any rate, my first tour of duty was West Berlin, which was an exciting time to be there. The wall hadn't come down. We still had mutual assured destruction. War with the Soviet Union was very much a fear. And in fact, when the wall came down in 1989, I called the girl that was my roommate during that time in Berlin. And I said, did we ever think we'd see in our lifetime the wall come down? Thank you, Mr. Reagan. Mm-hmm. Even though at the time I was not a conservative and I was not a fan of Reagan, but times change. We get older and wiser. From there, I went to Texas, back to tech school, and I was the first woman instructor at our tech school. And I remember when I was first going into class, I was scared to death, and my supervisor said to me, just remember that you're older than they are.
I thought, so you got that going for you.
Yeah. So I thought, by only by a couple of years, I mean, you know, don't throw me over the wood chipper. But I did that, and I earned a Meritorious Service Medal because I helped create a test that predicted whether the students from Monterey Language School were going to pass our course. And they had some problems with the all-volunteer force learning the Russian. It's not an easy language to learn. And from there, I was commissioned. Now, I had to enlist because when they let the women in, you couldn't go into intelligence. So I was in signals intelligence. The women could only go in as enlisted. So I was enlisted for 5 years, and then I got a commission. And they sent me back to Germany. And then when I left there, I went to Augsburg. When I went there, I went back to Texas. Then they gave me orders to Hawaii, and I said, I don't know how to go to Hawaii. I only know how to go from Germany to Texas, to Germany to Texas. Any rate, I got out after 11 years active duty. I got out of the Air Force when I left Hawaii to go to law school, but I stayed in the reserves, so that's why I have 22 years service. And I will, we had two Marines at our Republican Women's Luncheon today, also talking about their experience. One of them had written her doctoral thesis on women generals in the military and how women had been integrated into the Marine Corps. That's quite a topic. But Sherry Hunt was there. In fact, both of those women were county commissioners in Havelock. One was Marianne, I forget her last name. But both of them mentioned that what we learned in the military was how to solve problems. And so we all made mention of the fact that when the colonel or the general says, here's the mission, get this done, you don't say, that's too hard. You have to find a way to get it done. And I give credit to all military people that they are very good at figuring out how to get it done. Mm-hmm. I can't remember ever a mission that we couldn't do.
I think observing on a number of aircraft carriers, because I was Navy, but again, the executive officer, again, as the captain says, we're going to do this. just like you said, the executive officer finds a way to do it.
That's right. I was an executive officer for a while for our colonel, and it was the best job I ever had because he'd call me into his office and say, "Lieutenant, I want you to do X, Y, Z." "Yes, sir." And I walk out the door and go, "I have no idea how to do X, Y, Z."
And often I would say that the senior officer, the commanding officer, did not want to know how you got it done.
No, he didn't. But as a young lieutenant, I have to say that what I learned was find the NCO that knows how to do it. And they'll either tell you how to do it or do it for you. It's called delegating.
Yes.
When I was an elected district attorney in New Mexico, and that was when Johnson was governor, and he was determined to run the state as a business. So we had to write a mission statement to go in with our budget, and our budget people had no clue how to write a mission statement. And then we had to have a vision statement. And then we had to link each thing we were asking for in our budget request back to the mission statement and the vision statement. And so my budget person came to me and said, "I have no idea how to do this." And I said, "I'll do it." Put the paper in the printer. Because if it's one thing I learned how to do is write a mission statement. And she said, "How'd you learn that?" And I said, "I learned it in the Air Force. No, it's not a problem." Her daughter ended up going in the Air Force. You know where they sent her? Minot, North Dakota, from New Mexico. The cold was a little bit...
overwhelming?
Overwhelming, yes, yes. She got out at the end of that tour. Anyway, that's my military service. The things that I learned in the military have stood me in good stead for the rest of my working life. And I'm so thankful that I had the opportunity to have that experience. But I'll never forget makeup class and my wraparound skirt.
Oh.
I bet you can't beat that one.
No, we cannot beat that one. And you know, the funny thing is that the things that you remember from the military, because we remember some really good things, we also remember some really, really horrid things.
Yeah, let's don't talk about that.
And we don't, but... You know, again, it's a job you love to hate.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do remember.
Well, they say if the GRs aren't complaining, they're not happy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Folks, on that, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters. Again, this is CCTA Wake Up Call.
Since 1952, the North Carolina Fisheries Association has been working to ensure access for fishermen and consumers to enjoy fresh local seafood. The North Carolina Fisheries Association is for fair, science-based fisheries management for commercial and recreational fishermen. If you agree with this philosophy, become a member. For more information, log on to ncfish.org. For fresh North Carolina seafood, there's no better place than B&J Seafood, Highway 70 East in New Bern.
Round here, folks like to talk to each other, get to know you, look you in the eye, and see that you care. We call it the human touch. Whether you were born here or moved here really doesn't matter as far as we're concerned. You're from round here, and since 1905, folks like you have been calling folks like us for their auto, home, life, and business insurance. So come see us, or just give us a call, and we'll get you the best insurance protection possible at a real affordable price. We're Robinson & Stith Insurance, because when you really need help, you'll want somebody from round here.
Dr. Jay Singleton and his staff spend a lot of time removing cataracts, and they are good at it. Dr. Singleton has been doing a high volume of these procedures for 15 years, and the state-of-the-art Singleton Surgery Center is bringing costs down for patients and participating insurance companies. For dedication, experience, and convenience, you can trust the Singleton team. Dr. Jay Singleton and the Singleton Vision Center is conveniently located at 3515 Trent Road in New Bern.
Just who are these people doing this CCTA program? People in the community that love this country to protect individual liberty, and to preserve the U.S. Constitution and free enterprise system. To learn more, go to cctaxpayers.com. That's cctaxpayers.com. Join Coastal Carolina Taxpayers Association and make your voice heard.
Welcome back again. Thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters. Alan, you have any?
I'll just kind of follow up Pat. She had more years in the service than I did. I went in the U.S. Army in 1966 in June. And at that time, the draft was on. I did not get drafted. I volunteered. And I never regretted it. I went immediately into the infantry, which is where they had the biggest demand. You didn't have a choice. The Army had what they call a dream sheet, where if you want to go to a particular assignment or whatever, you put in this request, and it's never actually followed. So they called it a dream sheet, but anyway. I was in the infantry for my first 6 months. I did advanced infantry training and so on. But I do remember the camaraderie of the men and the competition between the men. It was do your best, and not only for yourself, but for your platoon, your squad, whatever. And that, I think, was really important to me. And I learned to persevere and work as a team, which is very important. After I did the infantry training, and we were at that time, we were still using the M14, some of the old weapons from actually where I went, did my basic training. It was in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Have you ever been to Fort Jackson, South Carolina?
It's hot.
You don't want to go there in July and August.
No, it's hot.
And that's when we were down there. We had guys falling out. We'd have to go through our runs to take it to the hospital. Anyway, it was extremely hot place to be. But the basic training was interesting, how the men would come along. You'd have people who seemingly were kind of weak and kind of puny looking. They would actually gain weight and strength. But by the end of 8 weeks, I was talking about 8 weeks, then you see these other people that were, you know, way overweight, they would shrink down. So there was a lot of people getting their uniforms readjusted after 8 weeks to make it so they get something fit. But after that, somehow or other, I got selected to go to Officers Canada School in the Transportation Corps, which was up in Fort Eustis, Virginia. And that was an experience, learning about the different means of transportation, the trucks, the amphibious vehicles, and so on. And then I thought that after that, that was 6 months, that was the end of my first year, I thought I would probably be going over to Vietnam. But I wound up, my first assignment was in Germany, a place called Zweibrücken, which means two brooks in German.
Bridges.
Yeah, right. And anyway, so I went there, and it was just at the time when France was kicking the U.S. services people out of their country. So all this equipment was being moved from France into Germany because the French didn't want us there anymore. And so that was kind of a challenge. And I stayed there. I did not live on the Army base because it was very limited. I lived down in the German, what they call German economy, which is down amongst the German people. But most of the people who worked in the motor pool and the transportation unit that I supervised, I'd say probably 75% of them were German nationals. And they were good people, hardworking. I had taken a couple of years of German before I was, and that may have been, I always thought, well, maybe that's why they assigned me to Germany, but that's given a lot of credit. That's given a lot of credit to the Army for sorting things out. I think it was just an accident, but anyway. So I was there, and then after I made first lieutenant, and then they offered me the captaincy, and become a captain, but I had to up my duration of my stay. I'd already gone 3.5 years. They wanted me to extend for another year. And at that time, I was married and had a son, and I decided I'd get out. Then I came back to the States. And so that was my Army experience. Positive, mostly positive. But to me, the manhood that the men showed to me was very impressive, and the camaraderie between each other. And you know, you really bind tightly with the people around you. They're going to help you. You're going to help them. It's all for self-protection.
I want to add on to that. During the 5 years I was enlisted, the camaraderie amongst the enlisted people is very tight. It's very good. And we learned to work as a team. Once I became an officer, I learned all the officers were out for themselves because you compete against every other officer. It's totally different from being enlisted. So my fondest 5 years are actually my 5 years as an enlisted troop.
Now I have to start with the Navy. I have to start Christmas Eve, 1965. I get a letter in the mail. Greetings. Uncle Sam wants you in the Army. And okay, Christmas Eve, 1965. I had actually been working in a recording studio in New York City. I had a security clearance. I was working on training films with folks that came up, Navy folks that came up from D.C. to work on the films with me. And I'm not directly involved in the films, but I had to have the clearance to be on the crew that worked with them. So I asked them, what should I do? Well, you need to join the Navy, get the cachet program, you're caught. And you need to get guaranteed Group 9, which is aviation. We'll make you a photographer's mate. We'll put you on the same crew working from the military side instead of the civilian side. Sounds great. I did everything they said, the cachet program, the Group 9 guarantee, whatever else. I never, ever heard from them ever again.
Oh, dear.
Okay. But I was
That's like the dream sheet.
That's the, yeah. somewhat yeah. like the dream sheet. But I was in naval aviation. I got, after boot camp in Great Lakes, the problem with boot camp in Great Lakes, I went in March, and you get all four seasons in a single day, March through okay. And after I came out of that, I got stationed at Quonset, Rhode Island, and at what was called an S-2 squadron, anti-submarine warfare, the old, what's called the STOOF aircraft, and it was recip engines, and we were on the carriers and chasing submarines. First squadron I was in, again, working the line, which is out there. You get to wash the aircraft, you get to move the aircraft, you get to do everything about it. But the irony was, because I had known enough about the training films, I quickly got moved into the maintenance office, working with the aircraft logs and records, and keeping the plane's configuration and what's called high time. And I knew all of the systems within the aircraft at the time, and I knew enough about a couple of limited duty officers that sort of trusted me to not lie to them about what we had going. I did, as soon as I moved into the maintenance office, again, working with the logs and records, I did have to go to the commanding officer through the department and division head to tell him I need to ground every one of your aircraft.
Oh.
Because the kid that had been taking care of those logbooks before me had let high time plus 10% items stay on each aircraft, which you're allowed a 10% allowance with permission, but you're not allowed anything more than that, you know, over the high time. You're not allowed anything more than that unless you're in wartime. And so we had to down all of the aircraft, worked overnight, but got 6 of the 10 aircraft flyable.
They didn't consider Vietnam War wartime?
Not on the East Coast.
Not on the East Coast, again.
That's weird.
But you went out on the carriers, just like you said, the camaraderie of the men. Now, we slept under the flight deck, so we heard everything landing. We slept 5 high and no air conditioning, no nothing, and just had, I say, good camaraderie and
Were you ever on the flight deck?
Oh, I was on the flight deck an awful lot, yes.
Oh.
Yes.
What did you do on the flight deck?
Well, again, having worked back in the line, well, first off, I was, again, doing the maintenance dispatch so that the pilot would come back and had all the gripes or whatever else. Well, we'd go out and look at the aircraft and know which, what was fixed and what wasn't fixed. And so I kept, but also during times of taking a carrier out to sea during a hurricane, we kept a couple of aircraft on board. We flew many of them off. But what was fun to do during a hurricane?
What color shirt did you wear?
Well, I mostly had the brown shirt and then the green shirt, the maintenance shirt. Yeah.
Oh, I thought the green shirt was shooters.
No, green shirt is the maintenance green shirt. The yellow shirts are the one thing I will say is that, you know, it's funny, from a religious standpoint, there is only one God on the carrier, and he is called the air boss, no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought the green shirt, or at least the clips I've watched.
It was maintenance.
Are the ones that go out and check that hook is in the groove, and they have to tell the air boss that.
Well, those were the yellow shirts with a now again I'm trying to remember all of the shirts that again.
Yeah, the red was munitions, and the purple are gas.
And the air the white are the quality control.
Name your carriers.
Okay, I'm just going to cut this short and welcome Kim.
Hi. Okay.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters again. This is, what did you want?
I wanted you to name the carriers you were on.
All of my carriers are razor blades. The Essex, the Randolph, the Yorktown, the Intrepid, the Wasp.
Wow.
JFK?
That's a lot of carriers. JFK,
yeah. Well, because we were squadrons and we did tours down in Key West and out on
Oh, so you followed the squadron.
Yeah, two different squadrons, and finally I went into what was called the maintenance. I did the prediction, the statistics for the squadrons.
Yeah. How many years did you serve?
I only did 4 years. I got to say, I was going to do full 4 years. About 5 months in advance of 6 months in advance of my discharge date, they did what was called reduction in force.
Ah.
Everybody's going early. Okay. So I was planning to leaving early. And then they told me, no, you're not reduction in force. We're keeping you because you're a critical rate and we're going to Cuba. We're going to Guantanamo. So therefore you're staying. So if I'm a critical rate, is there a critical rate reenlistment bonus? Oh no, you're not critical. So that is the military methodology.
Important, but not
it's too important, but not too important. That's right. Don't let your head get too big.
Now we can go on a break.
Okay, now we're going to go on break again. This is CCT8 Wake Up Call. Thanks for staying with us.
At Professional Auto Service, keeping vehicles in top form and running well isn't just their business, it's the passion of folks who work there. If baling wire and duct tape is good enough, don't go near them. But if you take pride in your vehicle and reliability is important, go to 2215 Country Club Road in New Bern and let Professional Auto take care of your vehicle. You'll be pleased. That's Professional Auto Service, Country Club Road, New Bern.
Other restaurants claim their food is fresh and fast, but are they friendly? At Moore's, you're treated like family the minute you walk into their doors. With locations in Winterville, New Bern, Swansboro, Moorhead City, and Jacksonville, we've been practicing what we preach since 1945. At Moore's, our barbecue is slow-cooked and smoked over real wood daily until it's so tender it's falling off the bone. Combined with our fresh chicken, cooked-to-order seafood, and homemade fixins, we're sure you'll agree. If it's not Moore's, it's less.
Since 1952, the North Carolina Fisheries Association has been working to ensure access for fishermen and consumers to enjoy fresh local seafood. The North Carolina Fisheries Association is for fair, science-based fisheries management for commercial and recreational fishermen. If you agree with this philosophy, become a member. For more information, log on to ncfish.org. For fresh North Carolina seafood, there's no better place than B&J Seafood, Highway 70 East in New Bern.
The County Compass is a rapidly growing, free, weekly newspaper throughout eastern North Carolina. At the County Compass, we believe small business is the future of our great nation. Many small business owners have discovered that an ad in the County Compass each week is the most effective, the most affordable way to reach thousands of readers from all walks of life. At the County Compass, we focus entirely on local and regional news, coverage of important issues that directly affect your life. At the County Compass, we love our readers and we love our advertisers. This Thursday and every Thursday at more than 750 distribution points throughout eastern North Carolina, pick up your free copy of the County Compass newspaper.
Welcome back, and again, thank you for listening to just some remembrances about some military service, even though at Memorial Day we're trying to remember those that gave their ultimate sacrifice in battle for us. Again, we're going to change topics now. We want to go to
Tuesday's election.
Tuesday's election. We're recording on Wednesday, so it's new to us. What do we want to see?
Bye-bye, Al Green.
That's
bye-bye.
One of the things. Yeah,
that's bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And John Cornyn in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that. Well, you know, having listened to, I guess it was Clay and Buck yesterday, talking to both Cornyn and to Paxton, and, you know, it looked like a 50-50 toss-up, but the numbers were, what was it,
60-30.
63-37.
Yes,
you know, if anybody doubted Trump's influence with elections, that's got to disappear, because I think he was 37 and 0 before. 37 of people he endorsed won at different races, different levels. And yesterday was 38, or I don't know how many more he
I think he gained
yesterday.
Two more yesterday.
Gained two more yesterday.
That he
everybody that he endorsed.
He's 100%.
So, and that's great to see that, because that's showing that people... are the people who are voting are confident in what he's doing.
Which takes us back to our Senate not having the kahunas to back Trump's SAVE Act.
Agreed.
And if the Senate, remaining Senate people, doesn't get on the ball, they should be really scared, because the American people have a long memory.
I'm just wondering if what happened last night or Tuesday night in Texas is going to mean that the SAVE Act gets passed, because this is a warning to Senator Thune. He is losing his power. This is also going to make a serious difference in the 2028 midterms, because what you're seeing up until the past month, I would say, the Republicans had no reason to get out and vote. The people in the House and the Senate were not representing them. They've passed the big, beautiful bill and very little else. The Trump agenda is not getting through Congress. And the Trump agenda is generally fairly popular with the Republican voters. So if this continues, and I think we're done the primaries, I don't know, but if the RINOs continue getting removed or getting primaried, then this gives the Republican voters a reason to come out in November.
And it only takes one senator to come out and ask for Thune's authority to be challenged. It only takes one. The fact that we haven't had one disgusts me.
Willing to step up.
Well, I want to comment on what Mary just said. Thomas Massey and who was the other one?
Cassidy.
And our very own Tom Tillis have vowed to continue to obstruct Trump's agenda until they leave in January.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that's why, you know, the filibuster is so critical. If they would only get together and do away with the filibuster, or return to just a talking filibuster. Now they don't even have to do the talking. They just say, well, we're going to filibuster it. It's going to have to be done, because the Democrats aren't going to help us. And you have these Republicans now that they get back at Trump because Trump did not endorse them.
The establishment.
So what are they showing? They're showing they don't care about the country. They care about their own reputation and themselves first.
Mm-hmm. They're petty little people who are after their own power, and they don't represent the voters.
Yeah.
And the voters are starting to try to put people in there that will actually represent them.
Yep.
And if the voters believe that they can elect people who represent them, we will have turnout in the midterms. The only way we win in the midterms is with turnout.
I agree. And I also think that to go along with some of the fraud stuff that's going on, things that J.D. Vance is bringing out and the healthcare fraud, the Medicare fraud in different states, not just in one. But I think as the taxpayer starts to realize how corrupt some of the blue states were,
You're being polite.
Yes. But so I think that when it's easy to pretend it's not my money, but when it is your money, you take a look.
Yes.
And I just want to say, red states too. In fact, Ohio is in Vance's sights.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it's important that they evaluate and go after red states and blue so that it doesn't look so political, though it'll be painted that.
North Carolina is in his sights.
So I think that's important.
Problems too.
I'm ready to get rid of the frauds in every single state. Red, blue, you name it.
Yeah, she said North Carolina's in sights. The autism spending has gone from a million to 660 million.
Yeah, they want to know why.
I'm reading about it again this morning, or not again, but just reading about it. Stein is complaining that we're running out of Hurricane Helena money. We put so much money out there to repair Western North Carolina, and we see that things are being done either slipshod or a waste of money.
Well, still, because Trump took that over.
We're running out of state money. We're running out of state money.
And that's what's happened with these programs, because there are six states, including California, Colorado, Illinois, New York, Oregon and Washington, plus D.C.,
Minnesota,
that are violating the federal requirement. Right now, the federal restrictions are on, you cannot spend federal money on illegals for Medicare, okay, or Medicaid. That's the law. But they override that, and they're spending state money. So they are actually spending the taxpayers' money in these blue states to keep the spending on illegals. And, you would think that the taxpayers there in these states that are having to foot the bill would be up in arms about it. But they just go along with it, apparently, as long as it's a Democrat they vote for.
One of the things I would love to see really publicized is all of the campaign donations to all of Congress and our state legislators and our state officers and where they are from, because this fraud has been overlooked for a very long time and somebody's getting kickbacks.
OpenSecrets.com.
Yes.
You can go to that website and it's a national organization and you can find any campaign finance report. And it's really interesting when you look at them, as I have, that I would say a good 90% of every campaign is from PACs, your own party, or private industry.
Mm-hmm.
I would say less than 10% comes from We the People.
And I think you have two issues with this fraud stuff. Number one, it's in the Marxist playbook. You put forth government programs, and they keep expanding. Take more and more people, which is exactly what's happened with Medicaid.
Overwhelm
the system. For 9 years in North Carolina, they refused to expand Medicaid. And then Senator Berger comes along, and he changes his mind. He gets the rest of them, and they do something they shouldn't do. So that's one problem. And the other issue has to do with the fact of failure to supervise it. The people who are in a position they're supposed to be monitoring these expenses to make sure they're being legitimately applied. It's not their money, so they don't care. It's government largesse. It's like this, you know, never-ending money just dripping down from the sky, and they just spend it. They don't care where it goes.
But I don't understand. I worked for a company that it wasn't my money either, but I was held accountable.
But that's what I'm talking about. They're not held accountable.
Right. So it's not a matter it's not those people's money, because it is leadership that has to make sure people do the work.
And they should be held accountable.
Exactly.
Not just the fraudsters, but
that's
the
right.
people who are supposed to be supervising this money and how it's spent, they should be held accountable.
I agree 100%.
I was shocked at how much fraud there was in the Small Business Administration. They were giving out loans to children, to people that had no Social Security number, to illegals. The COVID loans were through the roof. And the woman, I don't know her name, but the woman that Trump put in charge of the SBA, I was listening to her one day on talk radio. She was being interviewed, and she was talking about these issues and how the SBA has cut all that out. You know, children, small business loans to children. Now, how brain dead do you have to be working at the SBA to approve a loan to a child?
Well, I don't know. You've got to start that lemonade stand somehow.
Plus, there is no ability to recover those funds
right.
from a child. There's no accountability. There's no collateral put up for any of this stuff.
And there's probably no criminal punishment for someone underage either.
Depends on their age.
Yeah. And that's probably on the fringe. I just think there has to be accountability. It doesn't matter that it's public money, not private corporate money.
I think as we've seen probably up until very, very recently, how hard was it to get rid of an incompetent federal employee?
Well, I don't think any of those federal organizations that write checks have a checkbook register where they're monitoring a decreasing balance as they go. They act like it's a never-ending balance.
Yeah. Well, that's not true, because every federal agency gets a budget, and they keep a sharp eye on it and spend it all before the end of the fiscal year.
Yes.
That's why you get all the steak for the troops in September.
Yeah, baseline budgeting.
Yeah, so they all know how much they've got. But the DOGE people showed us that the Treasury that was issuing the checks, they didn't keep a log.
They never linked it to an account that was supposed to come from.
I just want to put out an explanation. I think most people know, but maybe they don't, about baseline budgeting. It's how you can cut your budget and still have it increase 5%. Because the way baseline budgeting works is, let's say you had a budget of $100 for your department, and you put in a request for $110 the next year, and they came back and said, no, you can only have $105. Well, then you would write that up as a $5 budget cut, even though your budget increased $5. And that's why the budget keeps increasing when they claim it's cut.
Yeah, we did zero-based budgeting in the federal government for a while, but that's pretty much gone.
It is, yeah. And again, you had mentioned it earlier when you were talking to military-wise. You used to have something called the cost driver. Why do I need that line item?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to justify why that line item is there and what's it going to be used for.
You know, nope. The troops would debate the budget, too, because I know the Army was always complaining to the Air Force the fact that we got more money than they did. Well, we said planes cost more than tanks.
So do golf courses. So, okay. On that, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. The sponsors and supporters.
Thank you. What's the largest gun shop in Craven County? If you said East 70 Pond, you are correct. Since Drew got back from the most recent gun show, new guns have been pouring in faster than they can open the boxes. The large showroom at East 70 Pond, slam bam full of firearms, new guns and used guns, long guns and handguns. You will find weapons for self-defense, hunting, target shooting, and collectibles. The team at East 70 Pond is friendly, courteous, and knowledgeable, especially in the area of guns. If East 70 Pond doesn't have the gun you are looking for, they'll try to find it. If you want to do a gun transfer, East 70 Pond will help you do it right. If you are looking to buy, sell, or trade a gun, there's no better place to do it than East 70 Pond. Of course, East 70 has tools, electronics, trolling motors, and a great selection of jewelry. But their specialty is guns. And we're talking hundreds of guns. Come see for yourself. East 70 Pond, across from Craven County Fairgrounds, New Bern.
Other restaurants claim their food is fresh and fast, but are they friendly? At Moore's, you're treated like family the minute you walk into their doors. With locations in Winterville, New Bern, Swansboro, Moorhead City, and Jacksonville, we've been practicing what we preach since 1945. At Moore's, our barbecue is slow-cooked and smoked over real wood daily until it's so tender it's falling off the bone. Combined with our fresh chicken, cooked-to-order seafood, and homemade fixins, we're sure you'll agree. If it's not Moore's, it's less.
Round here, folks like to talk to each other, get to know you, look you in the eye, and see that you care. We call it the human touch. Whether you were born here or moved here really doesn't matter as far as we're concerned. You're from round here, and since 1905, folks like you have been calling folks like us for their auto, home, life, and business insurance. So come see us, or just give us a call, and we'll get you the best insurance protection possible at a real affordable price. We're Robinson & Stith Insurance, because when you really need help, you'll want somebody from round here.
At Professional Auto Service, keeping vehicles in top form and running well isn't just their business, it's the passion of folks who work there. If baling wire and duct tape is good enough, don't go near them. But if you take pride in your vehicle and reliability is important, go to 2215 Country Club Road in New Bern and let Professional Auto take care of your vehicle. You'll be pleased. That's Professional Auto Service, Country Club Road, New Bern.
Welcome back. Again, thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters. We're going to go shift directions. I think we're going to hit New York City. Now, what's going on in New York, Pat?
Well, like a good socialist, Mamdani has announced he's going to seize property of evil landlords, rehab the properties, and give them to low-income people.
Give.
So this is...
No, they're actually... I think they're managed by some nonprofit, which throws a flag up.
No, he wants to give them to nonprofits.
Right.
He's taking them from commercial landlords.
So give it to them. But as soon as you start getting nonprofits involved in something like this, that would be a big red flag for me.
Yeah, it's corruption.
So it'd be a nonprofit like Southern Poverty Law Center?
Yeah.
Something like that.
So what makes this legal that he could just seize property? Isn't that like stealing from the rich to give to the poor?
Yeah.
So what makes it legal?
I would have to see the statutes that he's been advised that he can seize these properties under, because I'm sure they have nuisance statutes, maintenance statutes, building requirements. And, you know, you hear about landlords that don't fix anything, people that live in apartments without a running toilet. One time I saw a clip of two old ladies living in an apartment in Pennsylvania, and they had water coming out of their light bulb in the kitchen. At any rate, I'd have to look at those statutes to see what kind of legal authority he's relying on, because otherwise it's unconstitutional.
Well, I'd just like to comment on this business in New York. I haven't been born and raised there until I was 8 years old. Forced my parents, had good sense to move. But anyway, the problem in New York has always been rent control. In other words, if you rent out to a renter and you're a landlord, you cannot increase that rent until that person moves out. Now, let's say you start having problems in the building. You have these various, they can't afford, the landlord is in a financial box because they have increasing expenses to keep the facilities properly, but they can't because they can't collect enough rent until that person moves out. And so what I'm saying is that what you see is not private people not doing what they should. It's, again, the impact of a Marxist program to restrict how private individuals, that is the landlords, can operate with their renters.
I read an article that indicated that part of that problem with those rent-controlled districts was that the people never moved out. They had family that would continue to stay there. As long as
generation after generation,
right? So the rent was never able to go up.
That was the case on Friends. Remember the series? They were living in that big apartment in New York, and it had belonged to her grandmother. And that's how they managed to be able to live in an apartment like that.
But it is a huge financial burden, because you can imagine that the property tax would go up just because property goes up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing is, this is typical Marxist ideology in at work, because they put in a regulation that restricts private industry from dealing with things appropriately. Then they turn around later and say, well, you didn't take care of things. Now we're going to take your property. And then they're going to turn it into a government-owned set of, residences, homes, properties. So there's your Marxist takeover.
You know, we've also seen the opposite effect, where someone is renting an apartment, you know, a 2-3-bedroom apartment, and they will move 3 or 4 or 5 families into those 3 or 4 bedrooms. So all of a sudden, you've got 9 or 11 or 15 people that are living in a single apartment, and there's no way that can be a good health environment.
Do you remember the town, I think it was Springfield, Ohio, where the Haitians were eating the pets? Remember when Trump was talking about that? They have a housing shortage there because the Haitians have 3 or 4 families living in these houses, and the landlords, because the feds are paying the Haitians, they can afford to jack up the rent and then shove 4 families in there. And so the locals are priced out of the rental market.
So I have a question, Pat. When Mondami was talking about taking over these buildings, rehabbing them for low-income people, what are the parameters for that? Are these legal people? Are they illegal people? Are they already homeless people? Or are people going to flood into New York because it's going to be free housing?
Well, I don't think it'll be free. I mean, it's got to be similar to Section 8, which is still ridiculous. I mean, we had a family in Tucumcari where I lived, and their rent was $1 a month, and they wouldn't pay it.
Can illegals get Section 8?
In New York, they're signing up illegals to vote.
I'm just saying, I don't see this is going to solve any housing problem. I think if it comes in with minimal to no restrictions, it's going to encourage people to go there and maintain the shortage that already exists.
Yeah.
Well, if I had property, and I was faced with the chance that they want to take this property over, do I steal everything out of my own building before they take it over?
So that
I'll take every bit of copper pipe, I'll take every bit of copper wire, I'll take everything out of that building.
There's also eminent domain that the government has taken land over for the greater good. And if there's a section that would be
I don't think they're going to be able to claim eminent domain in this circumstance.
It's not going to change purpose.
There was a study done in 2010 about what causes poverty in nations. And it was the work of someone named Hernando de Soto. And his conclusion was, the lack of formal property rights is the source of poverty in poor countries. Because if someone owns something, number one, they have pride in what they own, and number two, they can pass it down to the next generation. If you don't own it, you can't pass it down.
That reminds me of the old saying, no one washes a rental car.
That's exactly right. And one of the reasons that America has been as successful as it has was because our founding fathers believed in the free market.
Well, they believed in property rights.
Yes.
And that's why when, for example, when you sue over deprivation of rights, they talk about whether or not your property rights, you have a property interest in your First Amendment freedoms, which is an odd way of saying it, but it's addressed that way in the court. But our founding fathers were wise enough to know that if you don't have property rights, you don't have freedom.
Well, we also saw the situation in Connecticut where this little old lady's beach house was taken over, not by eminent domain, not because they were doing a highway or a public whatever, but for a company. And oddly enough, within 10 years, the company left, and you wound up with a piece
of... Never did build.
They never did build? Okay. But you wound up with a piece of abandoned property that wasn't generating the taxes it had generated when her house was on it.
Well, I have to say that however that was done had to be scammish in nature because it doesn't apply what I understand mm-hmm. to be eminent domain.
But it went through the Supreme Court and they upheld it.
The state or the federal?
It went through the U.S. Supreme Court and it was upheld.
Well, that was wrong.
It was.
I can say.
And I'm trying to think of the name of the...
Keeler. Was it Keeler?
It's close. It was Kyoto or something.
But I, out of everything that I believe in, personal property rights is near the top of my list.
Yes.
And when I go to any government interactions, meetings, discussions, and there's property right stuff involved, most of the time I'll make a comment that supports the people that own.
Mm-hmm. I have the article. It was Kelo versus the City of New London. And it went up to the Supreme Court. And they let it go through.
On what basis?
And this was an industry wanted to build there?
Yeah, Pfizer.
Pfizer, Big Pharma.
I remember that.
And it was...
I remember when that was going on.
Yeah, they ruled that the City of New London could, under the rule of eminent domain, seize the homes of several homeowners in order to use the land for a purpose that would generate more tax revenue for the city.
Yeah, that was controversial. That opinion was controversial.
It was, and it should have been, because it was wrong.
Yeah. That still makes me worry and be concerned about property taxes just in general. I'm changing the topic just a little bit, but we talked about it a little bit on a couple previous shows, where we've got generations of people getting older who own their homes, who are at risk of losing their home due to unrealized gains of the value of the property, but they're having to pay tax on it. They really need to look at something for these older people who own their homes and the property tax.
Well, my understanding, Kim, is that there is an effort now at the General Assembly to put the information into a referendum that may be out this fall that would address exactly what you're talking about, property taxes. There was another issue, that I can't remember what it was, but it was, again, this kind of to try to fight against this accelerating cost to just maintain your own lifestyle.
Right, right. That's good news.
That happened to a lot of those people whose homes burned down in the Pacific Palisades.
Yes.
They had inherited those homes from their parents when they were reasonably priced, and now they can't afford to rebuild because the houses have appreciated so much that you would have to be a millionaire to rebuild.
And also, California's tax structure is such that you pay taxes on what you paid for the house for as long as you own the house. So, for instance, I have a cousin in California. They bought their house in the 60s for $60,000. They sold it a few years ago for over $1 million. All that time, they paid real estate taxes on $60,000. The people who bought it will be paying real estate taxes on over $1 million.
That's why we don't live in California.
And that's why we don't live in California, yes. And
yeah. I get a kick out of Clay and Buck. Buck moved to Florida, and he calls it, or Clay did, he calls it the free state of Florida.
Free state. Okay. Folks, on that, we're going to have to end the show. Thank you for listening, and thank you for just staying with us. We again ask you to visit our sponsors and supporters. Again, thank you. This is CCTA Wake Up Call.